This program contains the truth and is void where prohibited, taxed, or otherwise restricted by law.
Okay, we're starting part two of The Road to Orwell, which is based on Ian Slater's book, The Road to Airstrip 1, published in 1985. I had asked for comments from you folks, if you so wish to chime in, on whether or not was Orwell's writing a prophecy, meaning it has to happen, or a warning, which I would say is it will happen unless you do such and such to avert it. All right, so let me read you two pretty salient comments that I got, and there'll be a third that you can hear posited by Dr. Eugene Naret in the hour that I've done with him, which will be up on the May 28th, the week of the May 28th shows. Here we go. It said, Eric Blair, and this is from Gordon Comstock, who very much is an aficionado of George Orwell and his works. Again, Eric Blair started out thinking mankind could be helped. That's what caused him, and causes most idealists, be they writers or whatever, to do what they do, to champion what they champion, at the cost of a decent life for themselves. For most of his life, Blair maintained his typical belief that most non-believers in Jesus Christ have, quote, someday, some way, mankind will finally figure it out. Men will live in peace. There will be far less employment, far less government interference, etc., etc. All right. Never mind the 5,000-plus years of recorded history that says otherwise. Someday people will figure it out in some small part because of the work that I'm going to put into it. And, of course, he's attributing this to Orwell's mindset. I believe that that's what most atheistic idealists believe. What else have they got? Orwell put himself through the ringer for years on behalf of helping and trying to enlighten society above and beyond what most idealists would do and have done. Examples from this extraordinary man's life abound. Living as a homeless guy for 6 months. Living as a poor, hardship-stricken coal miner for a number of months, volunteering to serve in the Spanish Civil War, and coming literally a millimeter away from death from a wound suffered there. In all this, he was like a medieval flagellant. He suffered the same cut, cut-up hands from harvesting the hops with the homeless guys. He suffered their stench, their fleas, the malnutrition of the miners, their dilapidated, overcrowded living conditions, not to mention suffering the miners' buttons. All down his back, one scab for each vertebrae of the spine, from bending, stooping, and scraping along cramped dark tunnels far beneath the surface of the earth. He suffered the near-fatal bullet wound in the neck and the fatigue and the lice all over his testicles, along with the other volunteer soldiers in the Spanish Civil War. He wrote about all of this and more. Yet this was a guy who had friends in the Astor clan and the Warburg clan and others. This was a guy who had connections enough so that he could usually get a mysterious loan from somewhere when he needed it most, and who was handpicked to work in an extremely sensitive area of the government in World War II, and whose wife was handpicked to work in an extremely sensitive area of the government censorship department, which we've alluded to also, in World War II. True to form, of course, Orwell chafed while working for the government, lying media, and soon walked. But the guy had connections, and yet he did what he did for, quote, the common man. This was truly an uncommon idealist here. Well, I think his idealism finally cracked up and hit a wall. He'd reached his limit on being able to deal with the willful ignorance of mankind when he saw the British media fall all over themselves to praise Uncle Joe Stalin. He tried and tried to wake up folks, yet too many folks wanted to remain ignorant and comfortable. I think Orwell was burning out on his optimism. Who wouldn't? Well, around this time, right after World War II, Orwell's wife died. It was a result of the war, indirectly, and he must have known that. She had a routine surgery performed right after World War II, but her stress level and immunity level had been severely compromised, just like the other bomb-ravaged Londoners, so she never woke up from the surgery. Orwell would have known that, probably. And then following closely on the heels of this, Orwell's sister died. If you read Orwell's writings, one theme that runs through them all is some sort of guilt he felt toward his behavior toward his sister. That ran all the way back to something he did in childhood. It's in 1984. It's in many other of his novels. To top it off, Orwell's health was failing. He had started writing 1984 around this time. These are all the reasons why this is arguably the darkest work of fiction ever written, which I want to add, Gordon, is I think the very same adjective that Dr. Eugene Naret responded with when I asked him about Orwell's work. Continuing with Comstock's reply, I think Orwell's optimism, his idealism, completely abandoned him during the time he wrote 1984, and I think what started out as a book which was meant to warn people instead became a far more sinister book, which was instead, or certainly also, meant to be a prophecy. Orwell was throwing it in our faces, but not as an insider like Huxley, who wanted all this to happen. Orwell was hurt and torn up and completely disillusioned due to mankind's stupidity and stubbornness and the brevity and harshness of life in general. He was beating us for our stupidity out of frustration. Look, the guy had a death wish by the time he seriously sat down to write 1984. Otherwise, he wouldn't have kept smoking after his TB was getting critical, and he wouldn't have moved to the island of Jura in northern Scotland, the worst possible climate for TB. There is also a story of one time when he was on Jura, some old friends came up to visit, and he took them all out on a boat and nearly drowned them all in some infamous whirlpool. This guy was bleeding, all right. So he destroys all hope for society in his book. He turns what was originally intended as a warning into a sarcastic prophecy out of spite. Why else would Orwell have made Winston Smith such an anti-hero? At one point in the book, Orwell has Winston declare that he would throw acid in the face of a child in order to promote a revolution. And the aforementioned cowardly act of Winston towards his sister is present when he stole his sister and his mother's last morsel of food. And the love affair between Winston and Julia is appalling for other reasons besides just the conditions they are forced to live in. Their, quote, love is also appalling because it is not love at all, but just mere animal lust. So there you have it. Orwell was deconstructing any hope for mankind, from hope in mankind's government, even to mankind's capacity to love. He destroyed it all in this book. So if I had to state, one way or another, where 1984 was a warning or a prophecy, I'd guess it started out as the former and ended up as the latter. Of course, all this negativity could have been avoided if Eric Blair knew our Lord and Savior, but that's another story, isn't it? Yeah, it is. And he might have still felt the same way, I think, as we all do, but there might have been a silver lining, as we believe there is, in a sense. Also from Scott, why would Orwell volunteer to fight in World War II if he thought that there were masters controlling both sides at the top? I've heard Alan Watts say that Orwell came back from the Spanish Civil War and told his fellow socialists they were being played from both sides at the top. They didn't want to hear it and turned against Orwell. Let me just stop and say there, you know, I've got to talk to Alan Watts again regarding this. It's not a big deal, but I don't even remember asking, and I don't remember Alan advancing any attribution to where this came from. Not that he wouldn't, don't get me wrong, but, you know, I want to look at Slater's work, and that's saying that's the gospel, as opposed to what Alan might have picked up also. So this is not a criticism, but I'd like to know if Orwell, in fact, had that attitude. If that's that is the case, this is extremely problematic. Why he, in fact, would go to fight in World War II unless he had a death wish. It also, this is Scott continuing, it seems to me Orwell viewed Hitler and Stalin as standalone tyrants in light of your talk, The Road of Orwell. He thought you had to stand up against tyranny because there was no other choice. If Orwell knew or believed there were higher powers, in parentheses, that is, bankers, and in parentheses, controlling both sides of the war for the purpose of creating the social conditions for a united Europe, it would be pointless to put on a uniform and fight against Hitler. I agree. If this is the case, identifying the true enemy and thinking of ways to resist seems to be a difficult task. And those are all good points. And again, I think a lot of this hinges on where Alan had gotten that information about Orwell knowing that they were both being played. Because his conduct in light of that, as Scott said, doesn't seem to be that of someone who understands it's a game. And so why am I going to put my butt on the line unless Orwell or Eric Blair had some kind of death wish, or even a bit of a machismo who said, you know, I want to be considered physically capable of going off to war like everyone else is and not being thought of as somebody who's 4F. That's just a guess. The story continues, and I would still ask folks If you can come down on one side or another, as the weather Orwell in 1984 was being prophetic, saying you cannot avoid this and this is what's going to happen, which I tend to believe, or whether he was warning us and saying this will happen if you don't do such and such. And you heard it from both Scott and Gordon Comstock. Gordon feels like it might started off as a prophecy and then wound up as a warning, if I got that correct. So we'll move on. This is part two of The Road to Orwell. This is coming from chapter 9, which I will finish completely, and then we'll go to 10 and 11, which is just full of nuggets. I promised that I would also, when I come to the sites, in other words, C-I-T-E-S, as to where some of this stuff comes from, or if there was any kind of expanding notes, which sometimes can be very fascinating, that I would share them with you. I did not do that in the first reading. And I'm just going to take a look at that which we might have passed. If you remember when he talked about being inside the whale, all right, there is something from Aldred, The Making of George Orwell, page 130 to 34. And it says, Aldred is particularly good in showing how Inside the Whale is an important autobiographical piece as well as a literary criticism of the 30s. Miller's position was not really pacifism, that's Henry Miller, but rather that involvement in such things as the Spanish War should not be motivated from a sense of duty to others. And moving along, I think in ground that we may have covered. Yeah, we did. Another thing it says from his wordling in his notes, we find him, Orwell, for example, using many of the essays of the 40s to investigate a phenomenon that we have seen disturbed him deeply, the lust for power, from Raffles and Miss Blandish. Wells, Hitler and the World State, and Lear, Tolstoy and the Fool, as Wordling also notes, he, Orwell, consistently uses popular literature as a tool of sociological investigation. I couldn't have butchered that up any more than I did, eh? And that's where we are right now, and I will refer back as we hit these so we don't miss the some of the real incisive notes and sites that Slater uses. All right, picking it up in chapter 9, it says, although Winston Smith discovers how the regime maintains power by reading Goldstein's theory of oligarchical collectivism, he does not fully understand the underlying motivations of the totalitarian state until he is faced by the interrogator O'Brien in the cells of the Ministry of Love. O'Brien demands, quote, you understand well enough how the party maintains itself in power. Now tell me why we cling to power. What is our motive? Why should we want power? Winston did not speak for another moment. He knew in advance what O'Brien would say, that the party did not seek power for its own ends, but only for the good of the majority, that it sought power because men in the mass were frail, cowardly creatures who could not endure liberty or face the truth, and must be ruled over and systematically deceived by others who were stronger than themselves, that the choice for mankind lay between freedom and happiness, and that, for the great bulk of mankind, happiness was better, that the party was the eternal guardian of the weak, a dedicated sect doing evil that good might come. Instead, O'Brien answers savagely that the party is totally uninterested in the good of others, in happiness, luxury, longevity, or money. We are interested solely in power, only power, pure power. 1984 is thus not the record of a modern state in which the perpetual uneasiness between man and man is maintained largely through unintentional exploitation, as was the case when Orwell wrote Down and Out in Paris and London and The Road to Wigan Pier. Rather, it is a state in which exploration is intentional, the realization of Orwell's old nightmare in 1939 of a state in which the ruling caste deceive their followers without deceiving themselves. Having criticized Burnham, now this is interesting. He refers to James Burnham, who I've spoken about before, being the author of The Managerial Revolution, being a Trotskyite and a supposed anti-communist, a Cold War warrior. But I really wonder if he didn't actually abet the whole notion of Trotskyism in that it's perpetual war for perpetual peace, and really was, you know, basically a stooge. Maybe he was wittingly involved in bringing about this world government. But what's interesting is, in this first mention of Burnham, there is no first name. So I went looking to see, okay, where else did I miss the mention of James Burnham? And there is none, which is kind of an interesting editing situation, because obviously when you refer to somebody the first time around, it's obviously the full name. There doesn't exist any other reference to Burnham prior to page 194 in this particular edition by Norton in 1985. So it looks like something was excised about Orwell's feeling towards comments about Burnham. So this is James Burnham. And I also have, as I've told you before, and you can still access this, by the way, from, I think it's Franklin Sempa. If you put a search in on Sempa plus James Burnham, you'll come up with a very interesting three-part series on Burnham, a very forgotten character in post-World War II United States, somebody I believe you could say was certainly, if not in the school of, but a compatriot of George Kennan. Here we go back in the book. It says, having criticized Burnham for assuming in his worldview, parentheses, in which there is an unalterable division of humanity into rulers and ruled, and in parentheses, that the power instinct, though admittedly confined to a few, is as natural an instinct as the desire for food, and therefore there is no need to explain it. Orwell makes the same assumption as Burnham. He simply and unequivocally assumes such a power hunger, and from that assumption proceeds the ultimate desire of Big Brother, total control of others' thoughts as well as their bodies. Because of this, it has been charged that Orwell's presentation of Big Brother's motivations in terms of pure power is ultimately unconvincing. That even the Nazis, for example, for all their power mania, preserve the belief in something else than power for power's sake, that, as in the case of their racist theories, they sincerely, if fanatically, retain to the end of the Reich. No doubt, Orwell does overstate his case, and such criticism of him is sound so far as it goes, but this is only as far as placing the Nazi Party, Nazi totalitarianism, alongside Orwell's vision for a comparison. What Orwell clearly wishes to show in his overstatement is that in the totalitarian states of the afterwar, the, quote, lust for naked power, end of quote, is growing. Such states, he claims, in comparison to older tyrannies, are less greedy for material possession, but much more hungry for pure power. He believes that unlike the time in which he wrote his English novels, status will no longer be measured in terms of property and power, but solely in terms of power. In doing so, he is assuming that people can change for the worse as easily as they can change for the better, that there are those for whom the wielding of power is an end in itself. In arguing this, Orwell avoids the pitfall of what he once called the, quote, lure of profundity, end of quote. That is, of thinking so deeply at times about a subject that multitudinous qualifications end up smothering an obvious truth. In this case, the truth is that from the harmless child who makes its pet perform for no good purpose to the man who delights in a crowd's instant response to his word, there is in human beings, for whatever reason and in varying degrees, a desire to control others. Perhaps it is, as O'Brien's later behavior suggests, because control of others' futures creates the illusion of control over one's own future and thereby affords a sense of security, a sense of the predictable, the known in the face of the vast unknown. Whatever the reason, the desire to control others exists. And Orwell's purpose was not to investigate the origin of the germ, but to warn that as easily as the drive for virtue can expand, the hunger for such power can grow until it finally consumes all of the hungers, including the desire to think and speak freely. This is the great and terrifying simplicity of his work on totalitarianism, which, in his opposition to Stalin, dates from the 30s when he wrote, quote, "We cannot be at all certain that human nature is constant. It may be just as possible to produce a breed of men who do not wish for liberty as to produce a breed of hornless cows. The Spanish Inquisition failed, for all its cruelty, to produce such a breed of men, argues Orwell, because it did not have available to it the apparatus of the modern state. The Oceania of 1984 is a modern state. What Orwell saw more clearly than most is that the technology of the 20th century, especially its sophisticated ability to invade the individual's privacy, makes for a totally new type of state. Quote, the radio, press censorship, standardized education, and the secret police have altered everything. Such methods, he believed, aided and abetted by high technology, would enable the state to exercise a much wider control than ever before, and together with the non-technical kind of oppressive social conventions that drove Flory to the ultimate act of alienation in Burmese days, widespread control would become total control. So we just eliminate some of those inside clauses. Let's just say the radio, press, censorship, standardized education, and the secret police have altered everything. Such methods, aided and abetted by high technology, would enable a state to exercise a much wider control than ever before. And together with the non-technical kind of oppressive social conventions that drove Flory to the ultimate act of alienation in Burmese days, again, it would exercise widespread control, and that would become total control, and we are seeing this, folks. The efficient use of technology under the control of relatively small sections of the population demands, of course, a high degree of centralization. Such centralization is the superstate of Oceania is oppressively evident in the complete physical and psychical, that is psychic, domination of life in London, in parentheses, the chief city of Airstrip 1, end of parentheses, by the four ministries. And I have to go back in here. I lost my place with chapter 9. But that particular statement that you just heard, these four ministries constitute the entire... Oh, I'm sorry. No, I'm jumping ahead a little. By the four ministries, okay? The complete physical and psychical domination of life in London by the four ministries. And that does have a pretty interesting footnote. It says, Orwell, 1984, page 6. At one point in Goldstein's theory, it is asserted that Oceania is not centralized in any way. This is an obvious and gross contradiction of the overwhelming fact that London is the, quote, chief city of Airstrip 1, end of quote, and is so completely dominated by the four ministries. All right. Winston Smith's apartment in Victory Mansion is dwarfed by the massive buildings of the Ministries of Truth, which is responsible for news, entertainment, and the arts, the Ministry of Peace, responsible for the matters of war, the Ministry of Love, responsible for law and order, and the Ministry of Plenty, responsible for economic affairs. These four ministries constitute the entire apparatus of government. While the centralization seems essential to the efficient use of power, it does not, however, necessarily assure efficiency in public services. Right. Indeed, the most immediately striking thing about 1984 is that apart from the surveillance systems, nothing seems to work properly. As Goldstein notes, except for the thought police, nothing is efficient. From page 1 of the book, Airstrip 1 strikes us being depressingly run down. This is not the futuristic setting marked by a Huxley-like Wellesian vision of chromium-plated efficiency or Bowling's vision of the, quote, streamlined men from Eastern Europe, end of quote. Instead, it conjures up visions of ill-fitting uniforms, armies of ersatz coffee machines that neither give you coffee nor return your coins. It is a world of Victory Mansions, hallways reeking of boiling cabbage and old mats, of elevators not working, of Victory gin that is cheap and oily, and of Victory cigarettes that empty if held upright. Basically, nothing works, right? We read of amateur repair jobs as performed by Winston Smith being, quote, an almost daily in irritation. And now we're going to go to a quote that comes from Wigan Pier. This is not a quote, but I mean this is a lift from the book Wigan Pier. Victory Mansions were old flats built in 1930 or thereabouts and were falling to pieces. The plaster flaked constantly from ceilings and walls. The pipes burst in every hard frost. The roof leaked whenever there was snow. The heating system was usually running at half steam when it was not closed down altogether from motives of economy. Repairs, except what you could do for yourself, had to be sanctioned by remote committees, which were liable to hold up even the mending of a window pane for 2 years. It struck him that the truly characteristic thing about modern life was not its cruelty and insecurity, but simply its barrenness, its dinginess, its listlessness. Life, if you looked about you, bore no resemblance not only to the lies that streamed out of the telescreens, but even to the ideals of enforcing obedience that the party was trying to achieve. Great areas of it, even for a party member, were neutral and non-political, a matter of slogging through dreary jobs, fighting for a place on the tube, darning a worn-out sock, cadging a saccharine tablet, saving a cigarette end. In a description that immediately recalls The Road to Wigan Pier, Orwell goes on, "The reality was decaying, dingy cities, where underfed people shuffle to and fro in leaky shoes, in patched-up 19th-century houses that smelt always of cabbage and bad laboratories." He seemed to see a vision of London, vast and ruinous, city of million dustbins, and mixed up with it was a picture of Mrs. Parson, a neighbor in Victory Mansions, a woman with a lined face and wispy hair, fiddling helplessly with a blocked waste pipe. Orwell's determination not to present the world of Airstrip 1 as one of glittering efficiency may seem puzzling at first sight. After all, he was ostensibly writing about the future. The explanation for his description is that he was not trying to describe a radically different physical world from the present, but a different psychological world, and even in this he sees 1984 as no more than an extension of present trends. It is the psychological future in the physical present. This is why such care was taken to establish the sense of post-World War II drabness, and why the most depressing aspect of the novel is not that it is merely imaginable, but that, in its physical setting at least, it is immediately recognizable by even those readers who have no experience of living in an age of severe economic depression or in post-war ruin, but have at least seen slums. Certainly that marked characteristic of 20th century society, the increasing trend to centralization, is instantly recognizable by everyone. It is this dominant fact in 1984 that reflects Orwell's concern in, quote, literature and totalitarianism, that centralization of economy in restricting one's economic freedom ultimately affects one's intellectual freedom. Whether the economy is called socialist or state capitalism does not matter, he argues, because in restricting one's economic liberty, intentionally or not, centralization affects a person's freedom to choose his own work, to move to and fro across the surface of the earth. The danger is that a restricted mentality is soon nurtured by the restricted body. And that is pretty heavy stuff, and as I said, I got to go back into Chapter 9 to at least give you that last quote from where it comes from, and that would be the remark about restricting one's economic freedom ultimately affects one's intellectual freedom. And here it is said, Orwell expressed the belief that the changeover to a centralized economy does of itself guarantee greater equality. But clearly he saw the dangers beyond a certain point, for in the same essay, and this would be the essay called The English People, he calls for less centralization, arguing that not only would this be good for English agriculture, but that diversity would strengthen national unity rather than weaken it. And isn't that interesting? Diversity would strengthen national unity rather than weaken it. All right, we'll drop it off there. We'll pick it up with more of the dangers of the totalitarian state, as is written about in Ian Slater's The Road to Airstrip 1. Back in 1985 it came out, and we will pick it up with Part 3 on The Road to Orwell. And again, if you have any comments, any questions, any input whatsoever, by all means, please do so. You know, I'd like to keep a little debate going between us, even though we don't do a live show anymore. And even at that, of course, a little frustrated by the fact that you folks had to use email or instant messaging services, but you did do that, and I appreciate it. So even in this case, too, why don't you weigh in on this? Because I think this is one of the greater mysteries of the 20th century. And I don't think you can find one more that impacts us because of the way we see our life turning, not only here in North America, but also in Western Europe and England and such. So thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned to our other programming. Know that it will all come up on a Monday, the very first Monday of every week. You'll see links prior to that, but understand that they will be made hot before just about, I guess it would be 9 a.m. Eastern, and that would be necessarily 1400 hours GMT. All right, thanks for being with us. Really appreciate it. And by all means, send your comments and questions and criticisms along. Thanks a lot, folks.
Please fasten your seatbelts.